Welcome to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us by the tree. In 8th century China, Chan Buddhism had been on the rise for some 200 years, but its core ideas and its sphere of influence were still in flux. What most distinguished the Chan tradition from other Buddhist beliefs was its apparent rejection of scholasticism and study in favor of embodied practice and the possibility of sudden enlightenment. And yet, Chan monks also produced, paradoxically, Chinese Buddhism's largest corpus of philosophical literature. The beliefs and the texts of this new school were put to the test from 792 to 794 at the Samye debate, when the Chan monk Mohayan challenged Indian traditions to decide the future of Tibetan Buddhism. Defending the suddenist Chan principle of immediate internal enlightenment, Mohayan wrote his case against the gradualist Indian monk Kamalashila. The stakes were not just philosophical, they were geopolitical.
The larger issue is that at that point, the Tibetans had established a large empire, and then they started to look to the east and then look to the west, trying to figure out how are we going to incorporate Buddhism as part of a state-sponsored religion. And then the question is, which form of Buddhism? Can we actually utilize Chinese Buddhism as the foundation, or should we actually turn to Indian Buddhism and search for the lamas, other experts, and the texts from there?
At home, Chan Buddhists also had to reckon with competing cultural traditions within China, particularly around the observance of liturgical rituals. Here again, Mohayan played a major combative role, arguing that such rituals were only for those, quote, of dull and inferior faculties, unquote, since true Buddhist practice was internal. In essence, rituals exemplified precisely the gradualist approach toward Buddhist practice that Mohayan had fought in the Samye debate. Curiously, though, as Chan became more and more established in China, its antipathy toward ritual was edited out of earlier scriptures, revised in the Song dynasty to be more ambivalent or even affirmative. Increasingly, by the 11th century, ritual practices experienced a resurgence in China around gatherings like the Jai Feast, aligning the goals of lay people and monastics, or monastics and ministers.
From a Chinese perspective, this goes all the way back to Confucius. So ritual always includes an internal dimension. It's about sincerity. It's about how you imagine you're interacting with the deities or ancestors. So in that sense, the Chan emphasis on the internal elements of a ritual is actually part of the cultural norm.
We're recording from the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford. I'm your host, Miles Osgood. My guest today is Alan Ding, Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. Alan received his bachelor's degree from Fudan University in Shanghai, his master's from Harvard University, and a PhD here at Stanford with his 2020 dissertation, Divine Transactions, The Transformation of Buddhist Public Liturgies at Dunhuang, 8th to 10th Centuries. Since moving from Stanford to DePaul, Alan has published articles in Buddhist Studies Review, the Journal of the American Oriental Society, Tong Studies, the Buddhist Road Paper, and History of Religions, continuing his work on liturgical practices and the links they reveal between Chinese Buddhism and the traditions of India and Tibet. It's those liturgical practices, and specifically the Jai Feast in Tang Dynasty China, that will be the subject of his first book, and it's the subject that brought him to campus for the Ho Center's workshop on food in Chinese religion. As you'll hear at the end of our conversation, food turns out to be a fruitful topic for all kinds of religious ideas, both material and spiritual, for the rituals of the meal, the social relationships of the table, the cultivation of aesthetic taste, and the imaginative transformation of physical goods into metaphysical ones. So let's not delay our own gathering any longer. It's time to head into the library. Thanks so much for being with us here today, Alan, and welcome back to Stanford.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. As I was going through your research, you know, one thing that really struck me is while you have this precise area of study that is going to be your emphasis in the book and something that you keep coming back to, namely Tang Dynasty China and Chan Buddhism in the 8th to 10th centuries, there is this consistent interest throughout all your work, going back to your dissertation, it seems, in what are the Indian and Tibetan sources of the ritual practices, liturgical practices of that period, of that region. And so I guess what I wanted to ask you, first of all, as a way of, you know, introducing yourself and talking about the course of your research is, you know, from going from Fudan to Harvard to Stanford to DePaul, and then last year being at the Ghent Center for Buddhist Studies, how do you keep a balance between these two regional interests? How have you found your footing in these different areas? Could you tell us a little bit about how you've kept these different tracks of your research going together?
Well, thank you for your observation. That kind of bring back a lot of memory, stretching all the way back to almost 15 years ago. Mm. But when I was an undergraduate student, I was interested in actually in Mongolian studies. Mm. And I realized that the Mongols had a lot of connection with Tibetan Lamas, and they were influenced by Tibetan cultures. I have to get to know Tibetan Buddhism at least a little bit. Mm. Then I realized that there's a whole world of Sanskrit literature behind the Tibetan Buddhism. And at the time, we had a quite good Sanskritists working at Fudan University. So then that got me started. And then I bring all the same kind of interest from Fudan to Harvard and spent 2 years at Harvard. Then I moved to Stanford, where I can find a lot of resources supporting what I'm interested in, and I was allowed to do whatever I'm planning to pursue. Mm. And eventually, I think what's actually interesting to me is that both the ritual and the Zen Buddhism are in cross tradition and the international phenomena. So if you, from my perspective, if I work on either of them or both of them, I get to use Sanskrit material, I get to use the Tibetan material, which would be kind of at least interesting for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that's great that you go from Mongolia to Tibet and then from Tibet back to Sanskrit. Does Mongolia continue to show up at all in your research, or is there, can you draw us the link between Mongolia and China, I guess?
So for example, the formation of a Tibetan Buddhist canon actually was under the influence of the compilation of a catalog that took place during the Mongol Yuan era. Mm. So there's still something I want to go back and to revisit even after so many years.
So there'll be a chance to go back and back full circle there. So, I mean, I think one thing we will end up talking about is the ways in which there are real harmonies and points of overlap between these traditions. But I was taking note, you know, just to stir the pot a little bit, I was taking note in a couple of your recent articles that you seemed interested in at least one point of contention or one historical point where at least scholars have emphasized the contention, which is the Samye debate. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about how that debate's been covered in the past, you know, whether it's even a debate in the first place, and then maybe we can work our way to thinking about, you know, more complex and comprehensive ways of thinking about it?
Good. So scholars have been thinking this is probably one of the most important, one of the several most important debates in the history of Buddhism. However, I think in the last two or three decades, we realized that there was probably no in-person debate. Hmm. So whatever happened would probably something similar to written exchange between the two parties. So the larger issue is that at that point, the Tibetans had established a large empire. Hmm. And then they started to look to the east and then look to the west, to trying to figure out how are we going to incorporate Buddhism into the as part of a state-sponsored religion. And then the question is, which form of Buddhism? Can we actually utilize Chinese Buddhism as the foundation, or should we actually turn to Indian Buddhism and search for the lamas, other experts, and the texts from there? So Samye debate kind of reflects, it's an inflection point. And from there, the Tibetans decided it's actually easier for us to actually lean towards the Indian Buddhism, which I think is actually a wise choice. But at some point, they have to figure out what's the difference between Chinese Buddhism and the Indian Buddhism.
Yeah. What, so why was that a wise choice, potentially, to lean towards Indian Buddhism, politically or philosophically?
So part of it has something to do with geopolitics, right? Because there is an empire in China, or there was a tradition of empire building in China, whereas India, the Indian cultural area, do not necessarily tend to produce larger, overstretching empires. Yeah, but the most important part is that it is very difficult to absorb Chinese Buddhism and build upon it if you're not using Chinese characters. So if you think about the Japanese Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, Vietnam Buddhism, these are part of the so-called Sinitic cultural circle. And they can just simply take over the canon and start to build on the existing Chinese Buddhist canon.
Yeah.
But the Tibetans have their own writing system, and the language is quite different from Chinese. So it's a little bit harder, I think. And at the same time, they have a lot of access to Indian masters. They can actually bring in very knowledgeable Indian masters, and they were very willing to work with the Tibetans.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it kind of comes down ultimately to shared culture and linguistic practicalities, perhaps more than philosophical distinctions. Is that right?
Exactly.
So because as I was learning about the Samyu debate and reading your research, you know, I was sort of taken with this philosophical distinction, right? That it's often summarized as this gradualist versus suddenist attitude towards the pace at which enlightenment happens. And it feels as though, you know, is that a question that empires would be interested in? Is that a political question? And are you saying that, in fact, that's right, that in that question is kind of beside the point for the decision that ultimately ends up being made? Or does it play a factor somehow?
So my observation, and I try to work it out in my papers, is that once the Chinese, the representative of Chinese Buddhism, which would be just one figure called Mo He Yan, once he started to debate or have some kind of exchange with the Indian side or the Indian Indo-Tibetan sides, actually it appears to me, at least, quite clear that they both are part of Buddhism, and they have a lot of common ground with each other, and both the party liked one of the most important sutra for both parties was the Lankavatara, and the Lankavatara had a syncretic position, and therefore they all have a sympathetic to syncretic position, which means they want to incorporate the most part of Buddhism and do not really want to exclude any existing important component of Buddhism. So in that sense, they can actually talk with each other. That actually says something about they belong to the same tradition under a larger umbrella term. So the difference this is also a historical moment for Chinese Buddhism, because this is on the cusp of the rise of Zen Buddhism or Chan Buddhism in China. Because of the existence of the common ground, so both parties actually agree that non-conceptuality is important, or a state of mind that can be categorized as non-conceptuality is important and is one of the most important goal of meditation. So they agree about that. What they don't agree with each other is how we're going to arrive at non-conceptuality. So this is where, so the Chan position is that if we are talking about non-conceptuality, then we need to get rid of all the concepts. Therefore, doctrine doesn't matter. You can get rid of all the doctrine, sutras, or theories. But for the Indian position, that's just the wrong approach, because without the doctrine, without the proper foundation, you'll never get the correct door into non-conceptuality to begin with. So therefore, for them, still the traditional training and the doctrinal foundation is important. They have to build can elaborate a foundation before you can try to meditate, start to meditate and enter, try to enter the state of non-conceptuality.
Yeah.
So they agree about almost a large portion of what Buddhism was. They only have a tiny bit of difference, I think.
Yeah, in terms of process. Okay, great. Well, so that makes me just want to ask a little bit again about sort of differences and similarities with regard to liturgical practices between these two traditions, because this is something you've worked on for quite a while, and I gather it's going to influence the book that's coming out next year. So specifically, one of the things that you're really interested in is kind of merit-making rituals and feast rituals and the Zhai feast in China. But before we get there, could we talk a little bit about what would have been the analogs in India and Tibet, and like how different are they, or how influential are they? If we, as it were, either turn back the clock or just move west, what kinds of similar rituals do we see in those regions?
So I think, so one of my premises is that the so-called Zhai rituals, so there are several different aspects to it, and you can actually claim there are different rituals that can be categorized as Zhai. But my claim is that, or my thesis is, everything can actually go back to India. Mm-hmm. We can find the similar elements in Indian Buddhism and the similar dynamics and the similar principles in Indian Buddhism. Mm. And that approach enables me to bring in Pali materials and the Tibetan materials.
So what are some of those basic shared principles?
So the one of the most, and this is not even a Buddhist principle, it's just an Indian custom. You, as a householder, you want to cater to, or you want to hold a feast that include religious experts. Could be Brahmins, could be all kinds of the so-called wanderers. And the Buddhist tradition produce one kind of wanderers.
Mm.
So, and that dynamic was imported into China, so the lay people would constantly hold feasts and invite Buddhist monks and nuns to participate.
Yeah, so is this for the spiritual benefit largely of the lay people, or is the merit making that's happening shared between the clergy and lay people in terms of, you know, who's benefiting spiritually from this gathering?
Yes, so for one, of course, the donors, the so-called Dana Party, they receive the meritorious rewards or karmic rewards, but also it's a chance to feed everyone.
Hmm.
So you can't be mad at the food.
So different kinds of benefits, spiritual and material benefits, a sort of exchange perhaps of those two categories. That makes sense. So one of the pieces that you wrote about in 2023 talks about the sort of erosion or alteration of Chan attitudes towards these kinds of rituals, specifically merit-making rituals. You mentioned that there's kind of an initial resistance, and that over time, maybe we approach something more like ambivalence or acceptance. What accounts for the resistance initially among Chan Buddhists to maybe this kind of liturgical practice or this kind of lay clerical meeting?
Yes. So come back to the point earlier I was trying to make, that if you think non-conceptuality is important, then you should lend less credence to any kind of concepts, which would include merit, feasts.
Mm.
They are just man-made, to a certain degree, constructed concepts. So on a rhetorical level, they would argue, ultimately, merit is not that important. Ultimately, ritual is just constructed human interaction, forms of human interaction. However, of course, the interesting part for me, at least, is if you look into what they were actually doing on a daily basis, it's all about rituals. And they also participate in all kinds of feasts. They actually invent different forms of, invented different forms of feasts. So it's not that they're rejecting ritual on a practical level. It's just rhetorically, they think that they have ways to transcend functioning as mere ritual masters.
So rituals are already happening, and they're a practical part of clerical life. And yet they initially don't need to be part of a kind of philosophical system of approaching non-conceptuality or meditation practices. That could be more personal or internal and not rely on this kind of social interdependence.
And that's actually a good observation because from a Chinese perspective, this goes all the way back to Confucius. So ritual always includes an internal dimension. It's about the sincerity. It's about how you imagine you're interacting with the deities or ancestors. So in that sense, the Chan emphasis on the internal elements of a ritual is actually part of the cultural norm.
I see. So there's a way in which it kind of aligns with other Chinese practices, other Chinese religious practices. So that leads me to ask you a little bit about sort of what is the diversity of these practices in Tang China. You talk about, you know, they're not being necessarily just kind of one programmatic system of the Zhai feast, but they're but kind of tracking through the literature different ways this might have manifested itself. How varied are these events?
So in my book, half of it talk about observances, half of it talks about feasts. So it just happened, it's a coincidence that they use the same word to translate both feast and observances. Mm. There's no really philosophical reason for doing that. This is a linguistic choice that they made. Then if you combine both the observances, which include actually half-day fast, and the feast, then almost you can use this word as a synonym for liturgy or just a ritual because it's already included so many things.
Yeah, that's wild. So asking about the range of what these practices could look like from fast to feast, you know, almost diametrical opposites. And then I suppose I want to know, you're looking at a very particular period where these things are happening. Does the term start to mean something else going forward? Does it just die out of practice? Are there other kinds of practices that take over? Why would we stop looking at the 10th century, or what should we look at next if we kind of keep going in history?
Yes, so the importance of the traditional style of feasts started to decline during the 10th century. They're still practiced even nowadays. The observances and the feasts, they are still practiced, but in a more elaborated form. Of course, the details have evolved. So the 10th century is a kind of, and the 10th century witnessed the rise of Chan Buddhism, which has started to build its own ritual repertoire. And then, so the same dynamic can be observed from or re-emerge in different forms. So in terms of continuity, the 10th century might be a good place to stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense. But then you do mention that there is versions of this re-elaborated today. Have you witnessed anything like this or gotten accounts of what those might look like? Or where would one look if one wanted to see the legacy of this 8th to 10th century practice in 2025?
So when I visit monasteries, I tend to linger in the vegetarian restaurants because that's where you can see the donors still bring monastics to the restaurant to buy them food as a form of offering. So the same dynamic goes all the back to the beginning of Buddhism.
Yeah, so this very basic cooperation and charity and support has some kind of bearing on that history. Yeah. Well, so you mentioned Confucius in passing, and so that this leads me to ask about the workshop that we just had here this weekend, the workshop on food and Chinese religion. We had such a, you know, wide variety of scholars who are working on very different things from you, topics like contemporary urban Chinese cuisine, food safety systems in Guangdong and Yunnan, the politics of meat eating and vegetarianism, even sort of a comparativist perspective on food offerings in the Afro-Caribbean diaspora. What unites you all in around food? What makes food a potentially interesting way of thinking about religion and Chinese religion in particular?
Good. So I think this is we all need to eat. That's one dimension of it. Right? Even the participants of the workshop had to eat. And then if you think about eating, of course, it provides a venue for cultural exchange and provides a venue for insisting cultural paradigm, like you would want to exclude certain kinds of food or consume certain kinds of food in the correct manner. So it's all coded in a certain way. not only food is or food related practices are coded, but also they always involve imagination. Especially in the religious setting, you would have to imagine certain spirits or certain kind of existence partake the feast or the food together with the rest of visible, invisible audience members. And also you would imagine the food is not just food. Imagine it has some kind of a secret quality. It cures your disease, or it quenches your spiritual thirst, or in certain way it gives you a karmic connection with other people. So food is always includes the dimension of imagination. So that's, and the religion is also part of religion is imagination.
Yeah.
So food is everyone participates in religious imagination one way or another when we consume food in a religious setting. And the other component or another side of the story is that food always reflects social structure and the social relationship. So for example, if I'm a donor and I bring food to the monks, to the monastics, so I'm actually I can perform the ritual from a higher position because I'm the one who has the economic means to actually bring in nutritious food. But on the spiritual level, I'm the disciple of the masters. I need to be great. I need to actually act as a inferior in this relationship. So there's a lot of dynamics, and it's never. And the one thing I realize is that the dynamics changes over time, and can be recaptured in a different set of symbols or coded system. So that's actually interesting to talk about with the specialists in other fields.
Yeah.
And they have their own insight into the system or the dynamics.
Is there something that became particularly clear to you about your area, you know, looking at this, at these universal facts about food and their relationship, not just to kind of material and social hierarchy, but as you say, to spirituality, to imagination? I think that's really a wonderful way of thinking about food, not just as a kind of cultural and essential material reality, but of having all these symbolic qualities to it as well. So is there something that became a light bulb moment for you about Chan Buddhism in the last couple of days, where you sort of realized, oh, this is one of our symbols that might have disappeared if not for food kind of rendering continuous, or you know, this is a way in which food is more than just material and social relations, but is about our obligations to one another, our potential to imagine. What's going through your mind now?
So one thing I want to figure out is that how is it possible food that generates or people would associate a certain kind of food with aesthetics. So there must be some very elaborate social processes that enable the people to use food as a way of expressing their preferences, the hierarchy, different kinds of hierarchy.
Yeah.
Eventually, we agree this is certain kind of food would be associated, for example, with the Zen aesthetics, however modern it is.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm still thinking about.
So quite literally linking food to taste in the sense of cultural taste and aesthetic taste. Is there a particular food item or food ritual that in the Chinese context, in the Chan context, comes to mind in terms of, oh, this is particular to this region or this particular to this culture where we can see an aesthetic preference?
For example, tea is always important in the Chan tradition, and that's how Chan actually spreads itself. It brings the tea culture to other East Asian areas, and they invent certain tea ceremonies. So this is clearly, and you can say tea absolutely gives you some kind of, drinking tea is an aesthetic choice. Because it's not just the sweet that appeals to our brain directly.
Yeah.
You have to cultivate yourself to be able to appreciate a certain kind of tea.
It's an acquired taste.
Acquired taste.
Yeah, and then does tea have a particular meaning specifically? So certainly within China, but then within Chinese Buddhism in particular, does it have, is it about that acquisition of an appreciation, or is there something about mental state selection, community around tea that is even more particular to Buddhism?
So part of it is, this is where it gets more and more complicated, mm-hmm. if you delve into the primary sources, because tea could be a euphemism for medicine, and the medicine could be a euphemism for food or even meals. So there are different levels of symbolism working, and so there are a lot of work could be done in that area.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, final question. I loved going through your bibliography and just noting the fun you seem to be having in teasing your readers with these intrigues around exciting titles around esoteric topics. You write about ornamenting liturgies on the scripts for the Jai Feast. You write about telling infelicities on hidden intelligibility, and the compatible and the comparable on the Samye debate that we talked about already. And we mentioned in passing antipathy, ambivalence, and acceptance as a title on Chan attitudes towards merit-making rituals. These are, you know, lovely main titles before the colon, before we get into the weeds of the academic work that you're doing. Do you have in mind, it sounds like maybe if you're past the editing stage, do you have in mind a title for the book that's coming? And what is it that you have to pack into that title to make it both intriguing and intelligible?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So my book title is Observances, Feasts, and Scripts, the Varieties of Jai in Medieval China. So quite bland. whatever titles we're using, ultimately, it's a matter of taste, but also a matter of market, where you're marketing to, or what kind of preferences the press has. But for me, it's of course, I want to use the title to express some kind of structure.
Yeah.
So either it's the structure of the paper, or it's some kind of a structure we can find in the topic. So I think it's better the title reflects something structural, and at the same time the title is not immediately transparent, so the reader can actually be puzzled or trying to piques their interest. That would be the best.
Does that mean we're going to go roughly through observances, scripts, and feasts, or is it that we need those three terms to understand Jai as something more than just a single definition?
So this is actually goes back to why I started to work on ritual. Is I realized those scripts, written scripts, are not actually blow by blow records of the ritual scene, and they're just they reflect certain elements that take place in the ritual process. So what I have to do is not only reconstruct what happened, but also imagine, try very hard to imagine the social relationships and the logistics and the temporal elements, all elements, but not actually reflected in the feasts or in the scripts. So I think if you ritual study actually includes a lot of imagination, and of course, what I want to do in my book is first establish the Indian precedents and trace the development from India to China, and then use the scripts as a vehicle for generating more imagination about what happened.
Yeah. That's lovely. And it makes sense. I mean, that if you think about a theatrical script, you have to take the same kind of imaginative approach. You have to think about, okay, what was actually the blocking on stage? What were the props? How was this line delivered? How might a director have altered something that happened here? If I think about the literary tradition, but you know, just lovely to kind of come full circle in this conversation and say there are acts of imagination that are happening around food, it sounds like, or around fasting, around other kinds of observances at these gatherings. But then there's also an act of imagination that the scholar has to take on to sort of figure out what was really happening besides a blow-by-blow, a play-by-play that would be unnecessarily simplistic and reductive. Well, I think that's a great teaser. So I hope folks are very excited for this book to come out and get your imaginations on what happened in this particular phase of history. It sounds like there's a lot to unpack, a lot to conjure, a lot to create. So we'll be looking forward to all of that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for coming back to Stanford. It was great to meet you and talk to you. Thanks again to Alan Ding for joining the show. Alan's book, Observances, Feasts, and Scripts, The Varieties of Jai in Chinese Buddhism from the 2nd to the 10th Century, will be published by University of Hawaii Press just a few months from now in February 2026. You can register online on the press's website today to get on the wait list. As always, the music for this episode is a recording from Ani Choying Drolma's Buddhist Chants and Songs, performed at Stanford's Memorial Church in 2017. Until next time, this has been the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast.